The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, battered in Glasgow, like a Mars bar. Liverpool, but seven past Rangers. Are Mo and Co back on the menu ahead of Man City? Or was this just another nine goals against Bournemouth? We bring you that and other hot midweek takeaways from the Napoli to the unhappily as toys exit the Mbappe pram again. And Barcelona-Inter, greatest group stage game ever. Plus Premier League previews, all coming up in this Totally Football Show. Hey listener, Thursday the 13th of October, and what a week it's been. We've got Rory Smith, Raphael Honigstein and Duncan Alexander here. Hello everyone.
Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Wow. What a week, eh? What a week. Exactly. Exactly.
That's someone at the door.
Right.
I'm not going, I'm just going to shut the door so the dog can't right. be heard anymore.
No problem, Rory. Hey, while Rory's just away from the mic, let me say that the Totally Football book is out now for all your reading about football needs and indeed your filling awkward spaces and stocking needs. The Totally Football book, it's out now. It features writing from all the greats. Raphael Honigstein's in there, Dom, Duncan, Sasha, Flo, The Horn, Charlie Eccleshare, etc. There's also a day-by-day diary. Oh, my favourite bit. There's a special make-your-own into Totally 150 quiz questions to see if you know more football trivia than our pundits. Here's a sample. Don't give the answers away, fellas. Might give the reels at the end. Question one, what did Mario Mandzukic do in the 2018 World Cup final that nobody else had ever done before? Listener, do you know? Question two, who were the only team to do the double over Manchester City last season? A little bit easier, that one. What about question three? Who was the first English player to score for a non-English side in a Champions League final? Lots of nods. Lots of nods from our panel. Of course, you'd expect that. Maybe. We'll drop the answers a little bit later on. That book, anyway, available to order from all good booksellers, including that big one online that pays all its tax, that one. Also, there's a link for how to buy it on our Twitter feed. Anybody else got a book they're hawking at the moment?
Yes. I'm shilling a book, but it's right. the advantage of my book is it features Duncan.
All right.
So you get two of us for the price of one. I think Raffy's referred to, actually. It's like a compendium of Totally guests.
Nice.
It's called Expected Goals. It's been very negatively reviewed in the New Statesman.
Has it? What did they say about it, Rory?
Yeah.
They got someone Jonathan Wilson?
No, they got someone who's also got a book about data to review a book about data, which strikes me as being an interesting policy.
Mm. Yeah.
But anyway, I'm going to have some very forthright things to say about the new edition of Soccernomics whenever I get the chance.
Boom. All right then. That's data with D-A-T-A, I have to stress, in case you thought it was a book about. Anyway, I've only seen glowing reviews. And not just from the official outlets, but from, you know, people in the know who've just said, this is fascinating stuff.
That's
what
very
a different
kind of
take on.
Well, I'm halfway through it and I'm enjoying it very much. Apart from the bits about me, because it's always weird reading about yourself in third person, isn't it? When you see your surname. But other than that, it's very good.
I think that probably happens to you more often than it does to the rest of us. To be fair, I don't think I've ever read about myself, but it is weird being quoted.
Don't check out our Twitter feed after this appearance, Rory. Okay, that's Expected Goals by Rory Smith. What's your favourite bit of it so far, Duncan?
Just all the early stuff. Like, you know, you forget how basic the world was back in the 90s and 2000s. And
There is a great line from Duncan in it that has stayed with me. That if it wasn't from Duncan, would be his favourite bit, which is where he describes the early Opta office, where they only had one computer connected to the internet. And he describes all of the staff queuing up like villagers at a well, which is... Which is vintage Alexander.
Magnificent. All right. Looking forward to more of that kind of thing over the next hour or so, listener. We have a lot to discuss. We'll try and keep it tight. But first off, Champions League. Five teams qualified this week across Tuesday and Wednesday. Man City and Bruges, both with goalless draws. Napoli, who beat Ajax 4-2 this time. Bayern, same scoreline for them as they won away to Plzeňa, and Real Madrid, thanks to a very, very last-gasp draw with Shakhtar Donetsk that also left Tony Rudiger needing 20 stitches in his head after a collision with Shakhtar's goalkeeper. Meanwhile, looking good and now top of their groups are Spurs, who beat Frankfurt 3-2 Wednesday, and Chelsea, who were 2-0 winners at San Siro against Milan. On Tuesday, Liverpool had a 7-1 win at Ibrox against Rangers. They're now 1 point from qualification. Not looking so good, though. Juventus, who lost 2-0 at Maccabi Haifa, and Barcelona, whose 3-3 draw on Wednesday with Inter leaves them third in the group with qualification out of their hands. Wow. Extraordinary game, that one. Rory, so you called it the best group stage game of all time.
I think I said it could be, which right. is, or might be, which is an important qualification, and I don't mean to be a pedant. It was an amazing game, but obviously as soon as I tweeted that, people suggested alternatives in a very polite way. The most popular suggestion of which were either of the Man United Barcelona games in 1999. And the one thing that I don't know and have not done the research about is whether in either of those games qualification was effectively on the line, as it was last night. Does Barcelona, the desperation that Barcelona showed was just they knew they had to win to prevent relying on Victoria Pilsen for qualification. I don't know if that was the case in 1999. They were both fantastic games, two brilliant teams. But last night was the best group stage game I've seen for a long, long time, unless people have alternatives.
Yeah. I mean, certainly the last 10 minutes were off the chain, as you would say, Rafa. Three goals in that period, as Lewandowski, who hadn't scored since match day one, reawakened to make it 2-2. They'd been trailing at this point, Barcelona, and out of the Champions League. But then Inter came back through Gosens. After a magnificent ball upfield from Onana, who just kind of spotted Lautaro Martinez marauding off upfield and thought, oh, hang on, how about I pump one up to him? And then he crosses it, Gosens makes it 3-2. And you think, wow, that's it. Barcelona are out. But Lewandowski in the 92nd minute. El remate, gol, Lewandowski, gol, Lewandowski, Lewandowski, Lewandowski. Levi, otra vez Levi, gol, Levi. Roberto Lewandowski. Even after that, even after having those three goals in kind of 9 minutes to take the game one way then the other, Christian Aslani should have scored. Should have squared it, in fact. Shouldn't have scored. He shouldn't have shot. He should have squared it to whoever was standing to his left. It may have been Gosens again, I'm not sure, screaming at him for the ball. But you also had a good two or three moments where it looked like Barca might break through after the third goal, and just the final pass was missing. You had this kind of, it's the loudest I've heard the Nou Camp for ages. It was actually quite a high quality game in attack, less so in defence. I thought Inter looked really smart for 89 minutes. It just kind of had everything. And the only slight shame, you know, is that it goes to head-to-head. And that means that there's no more drama, particularly just as long as Inter beat Pilsen, that's it, everything's done. Whereas if it went to, you know, if it went to goal difference ahead of head-to-head for the tiebreaker, then maybe we'd get a little bit more drama out of that group. But it was a truly spectacular game. Right. The point, as you point out, may well not be enough for Barcelona, because if Inter do get the win against Pilsen on match day 5, I mean, I have to say, of all the big clubs who might blow a big game like that, Inter would be pretty much the first one you'd suggest. But yeah, as long as they get that done, Barcelona are out of the Champions League with everything that implies for their precarious finances. Not a great Champions League this so far for Spanish sides. Real Madrid are through. Barcelona very much in doubt. Sevilla, no. Atletico Madrid are in trouble as well. They're third in their group, 2 points behind Porto, with Bruges already qualified. Bruges have already taken one of the places in the last 16 from Group B. Rafa, Bruges, the only side yet to concede, a 0-0 this time away to Atletico.
Yeah, they probably should have conceded, but Simon Mignolet was in inspired form. And for some strange reason, João Félix never entered the pitch, which is bizarre if you're chasing a goal or two. Yeah, I mean, Bruges, I think, are great for many reasons, but most of all, I think, because they put pay to that slightly tired narrative that the group stages are always so predictable and it's always the same teams and what's the point of watching? No, I think the group stages are brilliant. Yes, I might be slightly professionally biased because I do have a role to play in hyping the product, but I've always felt that people overplay the amount of sort of predictability that exists at this level and sort of constantly overlook the outliers. And there's always a couple of outliers. Bruges seemed to be the biggest one, having qualified with, what, two games to spare? I mean, it's incredible achievement.
Mignolet with 14 saves against Atletico Madrid across the two meetings. Juventus, that was pretty incredible as well, losing to a club who had failed to muster a single point in the Champions League for over 20 years. Every time you think they've hit their nadir, Juventus, they find a way to achieve a new low. And intriguingly, they'll have the opportunity to do that this Saturday. Having pretty much wrecked their hopes of making the last 16, they'll be facing Torino in the Turin derby. Di Maria will be out of the picture, and the only good performances they've had pretty much this season have been with him in the team. Rafa?
It's so weird how Juventus have gone from the poster boy of professional club management, frugality, good scouting, good marketing, so just all-round modern and smart, to being a total basket case. As someone who's across Italian football more than me, James, how have they achieved that?
Well, there was this feeling that they had to push on for the future. And I mean, the Ronaldo thing is, I think, what people point to as pivotal.
Ronaldo wrecked them.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
That's in not in so many words. Rory's shaping up to...
Yeah, I think there's an element of Ronaldo's like symptomatic of a change in thinking that was pretty disastrous. But at the same time, what's happened this season, the unravelling this season is almost inexplicable, because they haven't signed well. That's obvious. You know, signing Di Maria to a big contract when he's 34 and is only really interested in the World Cup is pretty stupid.
Mm. And letting Kulusevski go as well.
Letting Kulusevski go, even Bentancur as well. Like, they had quite a lot of promising young players that they just kind of gave up on for a bit. I think it was... I liked Max Allegri. I know that James Horncastle's kind of torn on this as well, because Allegri is very obviously a disaster, but is quite a nice bloke, so you don't want to say it too clearly. But he, you know, he's a manager of maybe of a different age, that it wasn't exactly a progressive appointment. But even so, for them to be this bad is extraordinary. I mean, yeah, you can say the club have taken their eye off the ball, they're distracted by the Super League, and Agnelli's kind of made a succession of poor decisions, and that they've maybe leaned too heavily into trying to be a lifestyle brand and stuff, not a sporting entity. But that doesn't explain the results they've had, or the performances that they've had, or quite how bad it's got, or the fact that Agnelli seems to think it's all going okay.
Well, no, I think he's aware that it's not, but he's very, in terms of the Juve brand and what they used to call the Juventus style, or Stile Juventus, part of that for him is the fact that he's not going to fire a manager, and particularly Allegri, who he's pretty closely tied with, in the middle of a season. I think this season, though, might be different for the simple reason that we have a World Cup, and thus a pause of kind of 6-7 weeks in the middle of it. And if, say, Juventus, I mean, I doubt they're going to make the last 16, it's not impossible, but if they don't make the last 16, and if they're significantly far from the top four when we break for the World Cup, they're currently 7 points off the side in fourth, then I think that even Agnelli might decide that it's time to clear out. I mean, there are so many things to say, but I think on the subject of, and I was talking about going to the future, but they went back to the past with Allegri, who'd been so successful for them previously, 5 Scudetti and, what was it, 2 Champions League finals. But this time around, there seems to be no connection between him and the team. One of the major tests, I think, of how a manager's doing is whether players get better or worse under their tutelage. And almost to a man, the Juve side are all playing worse. And the players that were under him last season, like De Ligt, all playing worse now than they have been previously. Vlahovic, who they bought for, what was it, 80 million euros, who was going to resolve everything, is looking a shadow of his former self.
The other thing that I think is significant is this is a really, really bad time to be an underperforming manager of a major team, because you have Thomas Tuchel and Maurizio Pochettino, who are both out of work. And I'm pretty sure that both of them, given kind of how their careers have gone, would probably consider Juventus a reasonable opportunity.
Mm.
And Zizou?
And Zizou, of course, yeah.
And Sean Dyche,
yeah. Yeah.
The big four.
Pressure building. The other side of things in Italy, as regards Europe, is, of course, Napoli, who are top of the table in Serie A and already qualified. 17 goals scored in their 4 Champions League matches. The record for the group stage is 25, so they're 8 goals off that. So if they can do that in their final 2 group matches. Absolutely a thrilling performance once again early on Wednesday at home to Ajax. Are Ajax actually not that good? That was a question that struck us watching some of the defending in that game.
Well, they only let in 19 goals in the league last season. Remember, the start of the season, they barely let in any, and they've conceded 10 in 2 games to Napoli. Obviously, they've changed manager, but I just think Napoli are kind of unplayable at the moment, and yeah, you know, every couple of years you get a team that, and sometimes, to be fair, it is Ajax, that just play really well and everyone wants to watch them. I mean, my theory, a bit like Leicester, as we said the other day, when they actually respectfully reburied Richard III and then they changed their form and won the league, I think naming the stadium after Maradona, finally honouring him properly, now good stuff's going to happen. So,
nice theory. Right, Frankfurt at Spurs beaten 3-2 by Spurs, who had Son Heung-min getting his groove back. He scored a brace. Harry Kane scored a penalty and missed a penalty. Slightly nervous end to this game, but Spurs are now top of Group D. Only 1 point ahead, though, of Marseille and Sporting, who are the two teams they're going to be facing next. In fact, only 3 points separating the whole group.
Yeah, I mean, who called Spurs the Harry Kane team? Was it Pep? I think it is very much the Harry Kane and Heung-min Son team, with a shout for Richarlison. But the rest of the team are kind of just sort of prodding along, making things happen for those guys up front in certain moments in time. Now, when it works, it's great. It's sort of a Conte tactical masterclass. Very, very difficult to play against. The results are good. But it is hard work, I think, for neutrals and even some of the Spurs fans themselves. But, you know, achieving results is, I guess, what Conte will be judged on. But they still had a couple of nervy minutes because they don't tend to control games. They tend to just soak up the pressure and they invite that pressure on to them at times. And even a 10-man Frankfurt with very limited means managed to very nearly snatch a draw. So, yeah, I'm still not quite sure about this Spurs team, I have to admit.
I think what Rafi says about the Champions League group stage is not quite deserving the reputation for predictability that they have is borne out by this and the Leverkusen group, that even at the start you'd have said, okay, Spurs and Atletico would qualify with ease, but there was always going to be a pretty good scrap for second in these groups, just that those Leverkusen, Porto, Bruges, you would have assumed were all quite well matched, and Marseille, Sporting and Frankfurt should have been, maybe Eintracht a little bit lower than Marseille and Sporting. Should have
what?
Been kind of
these are the Europa League winners you're talking about.
They
Rory.
Are the Europa League winners. And, I sh-
and
I
you're talking
them-
about Conte, who's Champions League.
And Marseille, who until...
Form is questionable.
2 weeks ago hadn't won a Champions League game since 1993 in questionable circumstances. But they all looked relatively well poised. And then you throw in the fact that Bruges have been extraordinary and they become really unpredictable groups. What I think people sometimes get confused with is they're not the sexy groups. Like you don't get a group with Real Madrid in it that's really unpredictable because it's Real Madrid.
Well, we kind of did actually 2 seasons back, but yeah, and last
year,
Real will occasionally give other teams a head start, but the ending is deeply predictable. And that's Real Madrid get 12 points.
Not so much for Barcelona, though.
Yeah, well, Barcelona. I think this sounds like an excuse. Barca have been a little bit unlucky this year. Does that is a bad group to be in? With Bayern and with Inter, that is unfortunate. If Barcelona had been in, for example, Tottenham's group, their life would have been a lot easier.
But that goes back to the fact that they changed it so that the top seeds were not the eight best teams in the continent, but the eight champions of note. But my theory is why people do think, as Raf says erroneously, that the group stage is bad, is because often match day five and match day six are bad, and that's what sticks in people's memories. Because as we mentioned earlier, you know, a lot of the groups are already finished. A lot of them can't be, you know, overturned because of the head-to-head rule. I mean, there were 36 goals last night, which is the most on a single day since match day three, one of the match day three days in 2014. I would say match day three, match day four are some of the best football you get every year, and then it tends to tail off quite badly.
Not this year, Duncan.
Not this year. This will be the best ever.
11 teams yet to book their place in the last 16. Of course, they're ditching this entire format not long from now. We've got one more season like this. Then how's it going to work? Was it two leagues of 20 or something? What is the deal after that?
Swiss model. You just say the Swiss model and pretend
you
understand
it. Yeah.
All right.
One league of 400 teams and they
just
play on an
oil Googling rig. Swiss model now. Oh,
10
that
group
wasn't
game?
What I was expecting.
10 group stage games, is it?
10 group stage games. And it's just a league. So it... Right. It's like a conference in American sport, so it depends on your record. It doesn't necessarily, it's not that you have to kind of nudge the other teams out. It's that the teams with the most points or the most wins or whatever will qualify.
I, for one, am looking forward to football's new paradigm.
Are there not some weird wild card things as well? I can't remember. It's very complicated.
It'll make one hell of a go show.
Yeah,
certainly will.
That's why they've done it.
Yeah.
It's community chess, I think.
Play your joker and your away goals count double. But for one fixture only. Chelsea got two away goals at San Siro. That was on Tuesday. Yeah, it wasn't a great game. Not least because of the, I'm going to say, pretty inexplicable decision by the referee to send off poor old Fikayo Tomori, who was looking for redemption, but instead got red. 20 minutes in, Aubameyang scored again. Boy, he's looking like a signing. Chelsea kept their third clean sheet in a row with Kepa as well. And that's four victories on the bounce for Graham Potter's Chelsea, who are top of Group E. Like Spurs, there's only 3 points separating the whole group, so not exactly done and dusted. They will be at Villa on Sunday.
I mean, just on that red card, by the letter of the law, that was the correct decision because he didn't try and play the ball. But, you know, if last weekend we were back to we want consistency, then Tuesday night was we want common sense, and then Wednesday night was back to consistency in the... in the eternal swingometer.
Although, I mean, others are better placed to answer this, but for the red card, you have to deny an obvious goal-scoring opportunity. The fact that Mount actually got a shot away, would you still say he denied that opportunity? I mean, he hindered him, he made it more difficult for him. Yeah, compromised, but not denied necessarily. So it felt strange all around, and I must say, some of the decision-making this match day seemed to be over-officious and too interventionist. I don't know why UEFA all of a sudden... It felt as if all of a sudden they've been particularly pernicious, is that a word?
Yeah, it's very much a word.
There was a Commodore Amiga game called Kickoff 2, which had an incredibly strict referee. And you never knew when you were going to get him, and it was pretty random, and it would just send off everyone. And I'm not averse to that in real life, that one match week of the Champions League, they tell refs, you've got to be, like, incredibly strict, and no one knows when it's coming.
No one knows when it's going to be. Love it. Love it.
You can never expect the kind of referee inquisition.
Okay. We'll be talking Premier League very shortly, listener. If you're here for Premier League chat, stand by. But meantime, the other big midweek story in Europe came from Paris, where one of the biggest names in world football declared he'd had enough. We'll talk about that next.
Would you like to be the fountain of football knowledge within your friendship group, either down the pub or in the group chat? Because if so, the Athletic Football Tactics podcast is surely the podcast for you. I'm Ali Maxwell, and every week the Athletic's tactics guru Michael Cox, its data whiz Mark Carey, and myself take a tactical deep dive into the week's biggest talking points. This week we'll be assessing the ever-changing role of the modern number 9 and wondering if it's having a renaissance, and if so, how Erling Haaland, Darwin Nunez and Gabriel Jesus's big summer moves have shaped that conversation. We're also taking a look at Manchester City against Liverpool and asking if this is still the biggest fixture that the Premier League has to offer or not. Make sure to check out our back catalogue too, 3 years worth of episodes featuring more nostalgic lookbacks at iconic teams and seasons from yesteryear, like Carlo Ancelotti's Christmas tree formation at AC Milan or Mesut Ozil's Arsenal legacy. It's good fun. And the experts bring a ton of insight. So join us. Just search for the Athletic Football Tactics podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And make sure to follow and subscribe so that you don't miss a single episode.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is the Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Tuesday afternoon in Paris, and Kylian Surprise from the camp of Kylian Mbappe, 143 days after signing a massive new deal with Paris Saint-Germain, Kylian declaring, or letting it be declared, that he felt betrayed and wants to leave the club in January. Why? And will he? Well, with the club and many pundits rushing to rubbish the story as mere rumours, let's hear from someone who spoke on Tuesday directly to the Mbappe entourage, Jules.
Hello, James.
Hello. Jules, I'm not surprised they called you with this. he feels betrayed, so it must be pretty awful what Paris Saint-Germain have done to him. What is it?
I knew you were going to go down that route. Because I know you don't agree with the fact that he feels the way he does.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you have to see it from his point of view in the sense that, okay, maybe he's high maintenance and maybe he's got high demands and all of that. But they basically said to him a lot of things. They promised a lot of things. And they haven't been kept, those promises. The things that they said would happen haven't happened. Like the fact that tactically the team would play differently, that Mbappe's positioning would be different to what it is this season. He was told that they would sign a big number nine, like a big name striker, proper striker to play up front with him, that he would not be the sort of center forward, if you want, the lone striker in the team, but that he would be playing off that striker with Messi next to him, that there were obviously no Neymar there, the club intending to sell him at the time. And none of that has happened. He was hoping that there would be more strengthening the defense, for example, with the arrival of a really good centre-back. That didn't happen either. I think he was maybe a bit disappointed at times with Christophe Galtier, the new manager, and some of his tactics. And overall, despite being a good season for PSG in terms of results and his own goal tally, for example, it's not on for him this season. So I think that was brewing. We knew there were tensions. We knew there was something happening, something going wrong. We knew he had a lot of resentment. And then all of that kind of exploded on Tuesday afternoon.
Tuesday afternoon, when it just so happened, they had a massive Champions League clash with Benfica happening in a few hours' time. Were they unaware of that? Why did they choose Tuesday afternoon just before the game to drop this?
I don't think they chose Tuesday. I think, as often with the Mbappe family, it's quite a lot about them and it's a lot about Kylian himself, and I think that's what he wants, that's what he likes.
Mm.
So for them, there's no an issue with timing. It's just, and if you actually look at his body language before that Benfica game, when he arrived at the Parc des Princes with the team bus, he was the last one to get off the bus, which is normal. It's everything, he does it all the time, him and his best pal Hakimi. But he knew that the cameras would be on him, and you could see that how he was looking at the camera, he was searching for the camera. Same through the game, he scored the penalty and PSG drew 1-1 in that game and they were pretty average. After the game as well, in the things that he posted yesterday on Wednesday, there was he had a day for his foundation in the south of France, in Nice. And again, he knew that everybody would be there sort of waiting, expecting to see something from him or maybe to hear from him. So I think he likes that. He likes that attention. And
okay. And
I think because he's made his mind up that he wants to go in January, and he was really happy for this to be out because he's got so much resentment towards the club.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't matter if it's a Monday or Tuesday or Sunday morning at night time before Champions League match at all. He just wanted this out.
Okay. For all the fuss then, Jules, do you think, will anything happen? Where do you think he will be playing come February?
Right now, PSG is saying he's not going to go in January. We won't let that happen. So he can try to force a move. He can sulk. He can go on strike. He can do anything he wants. They say, like, no way in January we let him go. I kind of believe them, but I think it would be very hard as well to keep him if he really doesn't want to be there. And if he keeps saying to the club, I want out, let me out, I want out, I've got this offer from Real Madrid, I've got that offer from Chelsea, I've got this offer from Liverpool, I can go to Bayern Munich. There's going to be a clash at some point. It has to be, because he wants to go in January and the club doesn't want to let him go in January. In the summer would be different. I think he certainly will not be there on September 1st. On February 1st, I think, unfortunately for him, he might still be a PSG player, because one, January is a very difficult month to do a transfer of this caliber, of this size. And because if you're PSG, again, it would be your season, your second half of the season would be very difficult if you let Mbappe go, unless you've got already a replacement, like you can bring in Rafael Leao or someone like that, which again, I think will prove very difficult in January.
Right, because it's not like they've got many other options up front. Jules, one last thing then. Before the January transfer window, there's also this World Cup thing they're having. How worried are you as a Frenchman, given the kind of increasingly evident sort of self-centeredness, I'm going to call it, of Mbappe, and the fact that you need a team with real unity and real harmony at the World Cup. How concerned are you with the potential combustibility of the French national side in Qatar, especially given that we've already seen Mbappe kind of kicking off a bit about the over that image rights business, what, about a month ago?
That's a good question. It's a good point. At least for the image rights incident, he had the backing. The squad was behind him. They were actually quite happy that he put himself forward and first to sort of root for the squad and get a better deal for all the players. But it could be a problem. Remember that penalty he missed against Switzerland at the Euros where no one came to kind of console him, really. And that was quite a striking image. He was not happy with it. He didn't feel the support was there for him. So there's something that Deschamps needs to keep an eye on. I think there's something that the team spirit was not as good at the Euros in 2021 than he was at the World Cup in 2018, for whatever reason. So this is something I think that Deschamps has been working quite hard on getting back and getting that sort of unity back, not just on Kylian, but in general within that squad. So I think this is something that Deschamps, and he's really good at that kind of things usually, will keep a really close eye on. And I would want to think that they've learned the lesson from what happened in 2021 in terms of the squads, where they stayed. All of that was, I think, linked to each other. And that they won't make the same mistakes again in Qatar this winter.
All right, Jules. Many, many thanks for joining us today. Look forward to catching up on Tuesday.
Thank you.
Julien Aron.
Yeah, good to hear Jules on this. I've been waiting for his input. I think it's interesting that we've now had two players sort of unofficially going, not on, but sort of on the record saying they want to leave their clubs. One is Kylian Mbappe, one is Cristiano Ronaldo. And it strikes me as a sign of weakness. If you've got many options, if you have a good idea of where you're going, there isn't really, in my view, that need to do that. You can just very quietly do your thing, safe in the knowledge that you'll have a way out, and you don't have to announce it to the whole world. So it seems very strange that somebody who's so good would seek that way. Maybe it wasn't planned. As Jules said, maybe just all accidental, but of course,
I mean, even within that Instagram post out on the weekend.
Well, exactly, and even within that, when journalists then call up his people, the people have said, yes, it's true, he wants to leave. So it is still very much briefed from his camp. I just don't understand the point of it.
I'm baffled by the use of this word betrayal. So you hear, and this isn't a criticism of Jules in the slightest, but you hear the reports coming out saying he feels betrayed, he feels they've let him down. And then, as you did, James, you say why? And it's like, well, he has to play as a number nine. And you're like, well, is that really enough? And then, like, I get his frustration that maybe some of the reinforcements in the summer that he was expecting didn't arrive. So they tried for Milan Skriniar all summer and couldn't get it over the line. They end up with a defence that's still Presnel Kimpembe and Sergio Ramos, which isn't really ideal. But they've also got Marquinhos, and they signed a load of quite smart midfielders. Vitinha's come in and done really well. They signed Carlos Soler from Valencia, Fabian Ruiz. Like, they are a stronger, more balanced side than they were. And it just seems really odd to me that after 4 months, he's basically decided, well, no, this isn't what I wanted, so I'm going. And there is this weird tension in the way that Mbappe's presented. So you speak to people and he comes across as being, in one sense, a really level-headed, collected, driven, ambitious and professional kind of player. Like, he's been learning English and Spanish for 15 years to get himself ready for a potential move to England or Spain. He's got business advisors, he's got a foundation that he's setting up, he's doing all this stuff. He wants to kind of be the LeBron James of European football, which he's in a position to do and kind of makes sense. And then he does this fairly continually, and it's a very odd mix of a player who is lionized by people around him for being mature, which I think is true, and yet he seems to have this unshakable desire to be a prima donna. And I find it really, really strange to know which one is the real Mbappe. And I think that's significant, because if your potential suitors, maybe for next summer rather than January, Real Madrid, I'm sure, would sign him if they can swallow their pride after what happened last summer. But if you're Pep Guardiola or Jurgen Klopp, would you think, do I want this guy who apparently wants the entire team to be built around him in exactly the way that he wants? I think that would, even for a player of Mbappe's talent, I think that's a red flag. And it just makes you wonder whether Mbappe maybe is doing something that's slightly old-fashioned, because the best teams in the world play in systems, and you don't get to say, well, I don't like this bit of the system, so you have to change it entirely for me. That is not the sort of thing that the elite coaches are going to do for you, no matter how good you are.
Although arguably that's what City have done with Haaland, but
that's a tweak rather than a full change. They've done a little bit more direct. They've done a little bit more, not even direct, more like first time with Haaland. Haaland still does what he's told. You know, he might not be touching the ball a lot, but he's part of the pressing patterns. He's doing all that. He's not saying, well, actually, do you know what? I want to be right back. So you've got to play me there.
Indeed. All right. Well, more to come on Mbappe and his potential destinations and that. Excitingly over the weeks to come. But next up, hey, let's get on to the weekend in the Premier League.
We're sponsored for this episode of the Totally Football Show by Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform helping you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, which is up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And what's more, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 support is there to help your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Now, because you listen to the Totally Football Show, you can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/totally, all in lowercase. So go to shopify.com/totally to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/totally. This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Ooh, Premier League, everybody. Friday, things get underway with Brentford-Brighton. There's four games on Saturday. You've got last place Leicester hosting Palace at lunchtime. Then at 3, fellow bottom three teams Wolves and Forest meet, and Fulham take on Bournemouth. Then, tea time, Spurs-Everton. Five games on Sunday. Saints-West Ham, Man United, Newcastle United, Aston Villa, Chelsea at 2, with at the same time Leeds facing leaders Arsenal. Only the Aston Villa Chelsea game of those four, by the way, will be on UK TV. Then at 4:30, it's the big one, Liverpool against Man City. And yes, we better start with that one. Liverpool-Man City, both in action midweek. Tuesday it was 0-0 for Manchester City, who wristed players away to Copenhagen. Foden, Haaland. Foden came on, but it was 0-0. Still there through to the last 16. Wednesday, Liverpool went to Ibrox to play Rangers. Quite a game, this. Rangers taking the lead in the first half. Liverpool only managing one shot in the opening 45 minutes. Then, in the second half, they found that spark that everyone was talking about.
They did, although it was against Rangers. I mean, remember last week we said they've beaten Rangers at home. Arsenal's probably going to be a tougher game. Now, I don't want to repeat myself, but let's also point out that Alan McGregor's debut in his career was in the same team as Claudio Caniggia. So it's been a long stretch. But, you know, Diego Jota created all three of Mohamed Salah's hat-trick goals. 6 minutes, 12 seconds, fastest ever Champions League hat-trick. Salah came on and played pretty central, which is what people have been asking for a little bit more as well. So I don't think you can read much into this game. But
can you read a lot into the fact that, Duncan, had you pressed play on Tiny Dancer by Elton John when Salah scored his first goal, the music would still have been playing when he completed the hat-trick?
You'd have had 5 seconds to choose another song, yeah. So it was a fast
And you'd
one.
Have enjoyed a lovely musical accompaniment to Very the return so. of Mo Salah to, you know, his previous goal-scoring heights.
I mean, I think the thing that's notable about it was that his finishes were, you know, classic Salah from a few seasons ago, you know, no backlift, almost not looking on some of them. So I think, I don't know what was said at halftime, obviously, but it did feel like a bit of a nadir had been reached after that first half. And we'll see how it translates on Sunday. But it's definitely a better position. Say they'd scraped a 2-1 win or something, or ended 2-2, then obviously winning 7-1 is better. But Liverpool do this. They scored 9 against Bournemouth. They're below Bournemouth in the league. They won 7-0 at Palace a couple of seasons ago and then went on that horrific run at home. And so often scoring a lot of goals actually just shows you a glimpse of what this team can be rather than what they actually are.
All right. Just to mention that Rangers are out of the last 16. Come match day 6, they'll be exiting the competition. They are still on to complete the worst group stage in Champions League history, if that's of interest. That's a record currently held by Dinamo Zagreb with no points and a goal difference of minus 19. Giovanni Rombronko's side are currently on no points and minus 15, so a little bit of work to do on that. They and Celtic both now definitely not qualifying for the knockout stages. All right. Are they back or is this another Bournemouth then? That's the question, unless anybody else wants to eulogise further. The 7-1 win for Liverpool. I mean, 7-1. I know it was Rangers, but 7-1, as I say.
Yeah, I think that the issue is who they're facing this weekend. I think if Duncan's right that it's Rangers and you can't be entirely sure kind of what that means, although I would say that it was a different order of performance in the second half to the 2-0 win at Anfield. I think that the fact that Klopp is changing formations is both creditworthy and slightly troubling. He's been criticised for being too wedded to the 4-3-3, but if you're then, they started 4-4-2 last night, they've played 4-2-4 previously, that does kind of suggest you don't quite know what the problem is or what the solution is. But at the same time, maybe the kind of the enforced changes, I think Konate being back is a huge advantage despite the fact that Matip's really good. Gomez makes them be a little bit more defensive, I think, which maybe in the form they're in is not a bad thing. And all of that would apply, and it might be that, you know, if they had a team from the bottom five at home this weekend, you'd say, right, this is the chance to kind of kick on and start building something, start playing their way back into form. The fact that it's Manchester City is maybe less than ideal for Liverpool.
Although, despite their domestic dominance, City have only won one of their last 19 visits in the Premier League to Anfield, both fixtures last season ending 2-2. With the home side taking the lead twice, but then getting pegged back. Rafa?
Yeah, it feels to me, and Duncan might have the numbers for this, as if Liverpool's work against the ball, their pressing, is just a little bit off. And I think the tweaking of the system, it looks as if it's a sort of a verdict on the midfield. But I think basically what Klopp's trying to do is have the better pressing structure, because whether it's a 4-2-3-1 or 4-4-2, it allows you to have four players up front and in theory have more pressure than with the three, especially if one or two out of three are perhaps not doing their job as well. So I think defensively that's where the biggest drop off has been. A Liverpool side that doesn't look sharp, that doesn't win the ball back in dangerous areas, that doesn't make it really difficult to play through them, they're only sort of half or less than half of what Liverpool should be. They can't rely on just playing football the way that maybe City and maybe a couple of other teams in Europe do. For them, it's all about that moment of explosiveness, that winning the ball high up, that making it difficult. And that seems to just missing a little bit at the moment. I don't think it's as bad as some people have said. I don't think they're going to have a bad season. But because of the injuries and because of the bad results, they're already out of the title race. And I think that's a huge blow and disappointment, because I'm pretty sure that Klopp would have gone into the season after the way that last season finished thinking, we are ready with this team to challenge again on all fronts, but results have run away from them domestically.
Surely he'll have gone into the season going, oh no, it's my seventh.
No, I don't think so.
No, all right.
The thing that Rafi says that I think has been lost a little bit is this kind of scale of Liverpool's collapse. And it has been a bitterly disappointing season so far for Liverpool. But they have only lost twice in the league. Mm. And they were taken apart by Napoli, although we have seen in recent weeks that maybe being taken apart by Napoli doesn't make them special. The disappointments, I think, more than anything, are the draws, the endless draws and the nature of the performances. I don't think that will change this weekend. But what Rafi says about the drop-off being slight, I think is right. That it's not that Liverpool are infinitely worse and just not doing the things that they normally do. I think it's the fact that they're doing the same things but a little bit less and quite a lot slower. It's a relatively minor difference that, because of the way that they're, of how fine-tuned that system is, has a major impact. That's the way that it kind of looks to me.
I'd hate to think what you guys would have said about Liverpool if they hadn't won 7-1 the other night.
No, but just to underline Rory's point, you see the same with City, or you saw the same with City when they had slow starts to the season last year, the year before. There was nothing really wrong with it, but just a team playing that sophisticated football, just being 10% off, actually adds up to a lot more.
But also it's that thing of back in the day, you could start a season like that and then recover and put a run together, whereas now you can't.
Now you find yourself 14 points behind Arsenal and 13 from City, who are top of pretty much everything apart from the Premier League table. They've scored the most goals, they've had the most shots, they've kept the most clean sheets, they've made the most passes, they've got the top scorer and the top assister. Although, I noticed that Roberto Firmino, with yesterday's goals, is now on 8 for October, which is only one behind Haaland. Duncan.
Yeah, I mean, I think this game is probably the most important first goal in the history of football, because obviously everyone knows that Liverpool have been conceding that a lot this season, 10 of 12, I think. But if you think back, and now I'm going to break one of my golden rules here, which is giving credence to the Community Shield, which you should never do, but Liverpool did play really well in that game, and crucially, they did score the opening goal, which obviously meant City had to come out a bit more, and it was a really entertaining game. Obviously, the very wrong narrative from some people after that match was that Nunes was amazing, which I think is still probably the case, but that Haaland wasn't ready to play in our league. Turns out he is. But yeah, I think if Liverpool can take the lead in this game, which is a big if, then I think it could be one of those, you know, all-time classics. But if City do, you know, Phil Foden invariably has an amazing game at Anfield. It seems to really bring out the best of him. That's a big task for Joe Gomez, to keep him quiet if he plays on that side. So yeah, I mean, I don't need to tell Jurgen Klopp this, but keep it tight for the first 20.
Good advice.
But that's been... Yeah. That's been the strangest thing about the Arsenal game, was that Liverpool went to the Emirates against this team with all this momentum and didn't keep it tight. They didn't seem to be willing to this sounds a bit judgmental and it's not meant to, but to have the humility to say, do you know what, these are playing better than us at the moment. We're just nothing's going to happen for 20 minutes and then we'll see where the wind blows us. I think for Liverpool, the points gap to City and Arsenal is irrelevant. They, as Rafi says, they're out of the title race. The aim for their season until the World Cup has to be to qualify from the Champions League to still be in it in February, which they are very close to now, and to be within touching distance of whoever's in fourth. Nothing else really is significant, and you just kind of have to hope that January is a different world. That has to be Liverpool's approach, is you cling on to fourth, fifth, sixth, wait for the World Cup break and see what happens after Christmas.
There's 6 points behind Chelsea in fourth at the moment.
And then you have a very refreshed, because they haven't gone to the World Cup, Trent, Mo Salah and Robertson.
There you go. All right. Well, a huge game. And a huge first goal, if someone scores it. 4:30, that one kicks off Sunday afternoon. Leaders Arsenal, meantime, will be at Leeds earlier on Sunday. They also have a trip to the Arctic Circle and back, excitingly, to Arsenal. They'll be taking on Bodø/Glimt in the Europa League on Thursday. If the Gunners win at Elland Road come Sunday lunchtime, it'll be their best ever start to a Premier League season. Not only that, Duncan, am I right in saying it would be the second best start ever by any team in this league?
Yeah, and the last four teams to start with 9 wins from 10 have all won the title. So, yeah, it's
there
on.
There you go. Arsenal's last visit to Leeds saw them win 4-1, although Leeds did have 11 players out injured or suspended that time.
That game's quite interesting, I think, because that was kind of when Arsenal were really struggling under Arteta a bit, and that was a real sort of, everyone thought they'll go to Leeds and get dominated, and they really sort of stepped up that day, and I think that was the sort of green shoots of what we're seeing now a little bit.
Whether they're genuine challenges or not, I think we have to give them credit for this amazing amount of progress that they have made this season. I think the jury was still out on Arteta not that long ago. I have a lot of Arsenal fans, and a lot of them were still split this year, this calendar year, on whether Arteta is the right man to take them forward. But you can see now how there is a plan. There is, as we say in Germany, a signature to this team that you can recognize. The energy and the sort of choreography that you see with the way they move forward in certain patterns and overwhelm opposition teams, it's quite amazing for a team that doesn't have any obvious superstars and has ditched its plan sort of to buy huge money tickets to a certain extent, although Gabriel Jesus of course was not cheap, but I'm thinking of our good friend Pepe. It's amazing. It's amazing what they've done. I think we must give them huge credit for that.
With the youngest, other than the Southampton, but the youngest team in the Premier League as well. So it's potentially, this is the first season of three or four or five really good seasons. So yeah, you can, sometimes with clubs you get this feeling that you got it with Liverpool a few seasons ago, that something was about to happen, and it did. And it does feel like that at Arsenal at the moment. And yeah, I think, as everyone said, that, you know, Leeds, Elland Road is that sort of classic test of a London team coming up to Yorkshire, but they should cope pretty well, I think.
Hmm. Well, lots of other things happening this weekend in the Premier League, and we'll be talking about some of it and on this day next.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
13th of October, listener. And if that sounds familiar, it's probably because that's today's date. But I mean, if it sounds familiar beyond that, it's because on this day, 29 years ago, the Netherlands met England in Rotterdam. Two great footballing nations competing for one place at USA 94, as Brian Moore put it in his preamble. And one of a game that really defined an era, perhaps, for the English national side. A great team talk from Graham Taylor ahead of the game.
In life, there's so many opportunities, and they're always round about us. But there's too many people in life that never see them. And then there are those people who see the opportunities, and they don't want to grasp it. And then there's the other people that generally are life's winners. They see the opportunities, they go looking for them, and when they see them, they grasp them. And that's what you're facing now on the football field, isn't it?
And also a great press conference I saw on YouTube just the other day, Graham Taylor admonishing a journalist for having a bad face and being downtrodden before the game. But I must say, those doubts, of course, were borne out.
Wow.
I'm not sure they could be blamed, the media, for having a pretty bad feeling about this game.
Well, who could be blamed? Perhaps the referee. England, of course, famously didn't get the result they needed. They didn't get to go to USA 94. It finished 2-0 to the Netherlands. It was the game of Ronald Koeman not getting a red card.
Need VAR, didn't we?
He's
going to
flick one now. He's going to flick one. Yeah, there you go. And then, of course, the farce against San Marino. It did give us, though, material for what was either the best English football documentary ever made, or possibly the best English football documentary ever made. I'm talking about The Impossible Job, a.k.a. Do I Not Like That? If you haven't seen it, see it. It's on YouTube, all of it. I saw the crucial bit again this morning. That's why I'm a little bit excited. Made by the wonderful Scottish director, Ken McGill. What a talent. Shout out to Ken. And of all the moments, I mean, there's so many glorious moments in it. Because you got players mic'd up during the training sessions. Above all, you've got Graham Taylor mic'd up right through that disastrous, ultimately qualifying campaign. And his bit when the penalties are not given and Koeman's not sent off for a clear last man foul on David Platt. I mean, it's just one of the most obvious red card decisions surely ever. And Graham Taylor inquires of the fourth official, what sort of thing is happening here? And then later on, the absolutely and really, really quite poignant line when he knows that the jig is up.
I'm just saying to your colleague, referee's got me the sack. Thank you ever so much for that, won't you?
Which, A, he resigned, so he wasn't sacked. And B, I would argue that Graham Taylor got himself the sack with a series of inept performances with one of England's best ever squads. But, you know,
respect the narrative, Duncan.
Well, it's a bit like people liking football shirts from the 90s that no one liked at the time. It's like, oh, Graham Taylor's reputation is, you know, he's a very nice man, etc. But that whole qualification process was terrible. And, you know, that's the last World Cup England weren't at. And it was a big loss.
If you were to flip reverse it, can you make a case that if England had gone to the World Cup, that influx of foreign players to the Premier League wouldn't have happened quite so easily. If England had gone and sort of got knocked out in the last 16 or whatever, would there have been the same impulse to go and buy all these foreign players because they were better than the players in our league, capital O, capital L?
I mean, if you remember the brouhaha about Klinsmann signing, your sort of counter factual history suggests that he might not have been signed if England had a good World Cup. I don't think that's true. I think that he would have still been seen as a massive attraction because these players just didn't rock up in the Premier League at the time because, A, they didn't pay that much money before. They had very little money in the 90s and late 80s, of course, even less. And B, because the standard of the Premier League was pretty poor.
Mm. Not like these days when you get matches like Nottingham Forest against Aston Villa.
Yeah.
He said, segueing along nicely. A game that took place on Monday night and was described by Daniel Story, if you didn't see it, listener. Apparently it was a cross between one of those Victorian scrums between two Derbyshire villages that had gone for 3 days and a 1987 First Division match. What does Daniel mean, Duncan?
Well, it was a functional display from both teams. It had a combined XG total of one, exactly one, which is the lowest of any game in the Premier League this season.
Two actual goals.
So, the traditionalists were knee sliding everywhere. But, Villa have now been involved in four of the six games with the lowest XG in the Premier League this season, which I think speaks to the sort of negativity around them. And pretty much every Villa fan I know or see online is not happy.
Mm. Is Steven Gerrard holding back Aston Villa or the other way around?
I think the former.
Okay.
I would say the former as well. I think I've had this argument with people quite a lot recently, to the extent that I actually got called out online by John Sitton.
Amazing. Bring your dinner.
I've not responded. I don't want to bring my dinner. But I think for managers of clubs of that level, it's really important to be able to sell the fans on a vision. You need to tell them that there's a style of play that you're trying to implement or a type of player that you want to emphasise, whether it's young or creative or whatever it is. And to an extent, it can all be
a philosophy, a project.
Yeah. And to an extent, it can be bullshit. It's fine if it's bullshit. No one's going to care. But you have to try and sell them on something. And I just think that Villa at the moment are a really clear example of a club where the manager has completely failed to convince the fans of what he is trying to do, what his vision is for the long term. If you look at Forest fans believe in what Steve Cooper is offering them. If you look at Southampton, where Hasenhüttl seems to have been on the brink of the sack for about 2 years, the fans basically believe in his vision of play, in his style, his approach. We're what, a year into Gerrard's reign at Villa, and I don't think the fans have got the slightest clue what a Steven Gerrard Aston Villa team looks like.
The worst thing that happened was Coutinho scoring and playing really well on his debut against Manchester United, because I think that kind of just set in motion that he was just going to amble around and score long-range goals and they'd be fine. And it's kind of since then, it's slowly got worse.
Well, with all of that, I am excited to say that Villa's clash with Chelsea is the one game being televised of those four 2 o'clock Sunday kickoffs. As for Forest, after their 1-1 draw on Monday, they will be facing Wolves Saturday at 3 o'clock. It's the first ever Premier League meeting between these two clubs. First top division meeting since March 1984. What was number one?
China in Your Hands by Tapao.
Great shout, Rory, but not correct. Feels like it should have been, but no, it was another iconic 80s track.
Tiffany, I think we're alone.
Something close at home for you, Rafa.
Kraftwerk.
No.
Beethoven.
No. Hold on, what year is this? Nina, 1999?
Boom. 1984. It wasn't 1999, of course, Rafa. It was
99 Luftballons.
Luftballons by Nina with her leather kecks and armpits and things, and really a revelatory moment, I think, for many. Oh, right, you're in a different bit. All right, listener, stop that. Interesting build-up to this game. Forest have fired all of the people who hired all of those players for them, but kept their manager. Wolves are still without a manager because it turns out Julen Lopetegui said no thank you. That's what we hear. Wolves have had one win in 16. Forest have had one win in 9.
Missing out on Lopetegui strikes me as maybe being a bullet dodge, just for the fact that they sacked Bruno Lage just his football was boring and they didn't score any goals. So why would you go and appoint Julian Lopetegui? What's the logic there? It doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever that he was their first. He's obviously got a decent CV and he did well at Porto, although that was quite some time ago.
He did well at Seville prior to this season.
He did okay at Seville, I think. I think he probably met expectations at Seville and massively underperformed in this season. They looked like they were in the title race for a bit last year, which I will grant you, James, was something of an achievement.
I mean, three top four finishes, but I guess it also speaks to the maybe decline of other traditional powers in La Liga.
But also, I mean, Sevilla had been kind of skirting and flirting with the top four before that anyway. That's just kind of, that has become their natural position in Spain. But it's the style of football, which is why Sevilla fans didn't really take to him, why it didn't work out. To then import that to a club where the fans are sick of not scoring goals and not attacking just seems really, really odd.
All right, well, looking forward to seeing who will be coming in then. In the meantime, they are taking on Nottingham Forest that Saturday at 3. Saturday tea time, it's Spurs-Everton. Conte Spurs beat Lampard Everton 5-0 in this fixture last season. Fulham-Bournemouth, there's also this weekend. There's Leicester Crystal Palace, there's Brentford against Brighton, and West Ham and Man United. I mentioned Man United taking on Newcastle. West Ham are going to be away at Saints. Both West Ham and Man United play in the Europa League and Conference League on Thursday. Man United are up against Omonia Nicosia and West Ham host Anderlecht. What of those games are you most excited by? Pick one and then we'll wrap it up for today. Duncan?
Man United, Newcastle,
oh, yeah.
I think. My favourite Premier League goal, the one where Wayne Rooney is arguing with the ref, jogs a bit, smashes it in and then turns back to the ref, which is always good. We've also seen Erling Haaland shatter most of Mick Quinn's records in recent weeks, but there are still a few that remain. He's still got the record of scoring in his first six Premier League appearances. Obviously, Anthony's 3-for-3 so far, so... We'll see if the Quinn family maintain any dominance of the league after the next few weeks.
Newcastle have only won once at Old Trafford in the last half a century. That victory coming, you may be unsurprised to hear, during the David Moyes season. Rafa, what game is catching your eye?
Well, I'm super excited about an 8-hour round train trip to Anfield.
Oh, yeah.
To watch England's best two teams of last season. Each other.
Yeah, kind of over the last 5 years, really.
Yeah,
fair enough. Rory, what's tickling your fancy?
Well, I mean, obviously, Liverpool City is the big game of the weekend. I think Leeds-Arsenal will be fascinating, but a little mention maybe for Fulham-Bournemouth, because they are two. Fulham have dipped just a little bit the last few weeks, but they are both massively overperforming expectations, I think. They're 8th versus 9th, which I'm pretty sure that 9, 10 games into the season, no one would have thought this would be 8th versus 9th, particularly in that order. Gary O'Neill, I think, has done a brilliant job. And I think Fulham looked like a decent bet to stay up. So they are two teams who both deserve credit for their start to the season, even though they haven't been spectacular.
Also, this was the top two from the Championship last season, and their clash at Craven Cottage in England's second tier saw that. Bournemouth goal straight from kickoff that everyone got very excited about.
Oh, yeah. Also, Bournemouth, just to back up Rory's point, one of the biggest overperformances I've ever seen from a team. They've got less than 5 XG this season, and they've got 12 points. It's breaking all.
Breaking.
Yeah. So it's probably not going to last, but, you know, don't appoint Gary O'Neill permanently because I think that will break the spell. Just leave it. One of those things, don't touch anything. You know, like if your phone charger's not working, you get it just to work. Just stand
back. Like Ole Gunnar Solskjaer at Man United or a phone charger. I mean, both valid.
Both have
analogies. Okay. Nobody mentioned Saints West Ham, which has ended 0-0 in the last two seasons in the Premier League. But it's happening. Sunday, 2 o'clock. Very good. Well, I hope you do have an enjoyable weekend on and off the field, whatever it is you're watching. Thanks for being with us today to Rafa, to Duncan, to Rory, to producer Charlie, and you, listener. We'll be back on Monday to round up all of the drama and the excitement. I do hope you'll be joining us for that. For now, from all of us here, it's goodbye. Oh, the questions. Wait, the questions. That's right. If you want to play this along at home and you've got your order in for the Totally Football book, listen away now, if you know what I mean. Right? Everybody gone who doesn't want to know? All right then, here's the answers. What did Mario Mandzukic do in the 2018 World Cup final that no one had ever done before? Anybody?
Score and get sent off?
Score a goal and an own goal in the final.
Yeah.
Question two. Who were the only team to do the double over Manchester City last season?
Palace?
No, I thought this was the Spurs.
Oh, yeah.
Question three. Who was the first English player to score for a non-English side in a Champions League final?
Steve McManaman?
Yeah, McManaman.
Boom. Yeah, that's right, listener. It was. All right, we're back on Monday. See you then.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts. Find out the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally.
The Athletic.